This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to Go Home in a Box. After a week off, we are your podcast source for discussion of genre films. Much like days when you would traverse the aisles of your mom and pop video looking for that hidden treasure, we are the ones who find it before you and keep it for a lot longer than we really need to. You know, we're a couple of movie geeks. This is our show. We just want to inform and enlighten the masses on some great films you may have missed the first time around. I am one of your grateful co-hosts, Chris Jordan. You can find me online at RetroMovieNerd.com, where last week, because we took a week off, we didn't get a chance to plug it, I reviewed David Lynch's prequel to the original Twin Peaks series, Fire Walk With Me. Now, this is the third Lynch film I've reviewed for the site, along with Eraserhead, Dune. And this is the third Lynch film that has totally fucking confused the shit out of me. This week, however, I review a film that is much less confusing and totally more enjoyable, Universal Soldier. Jean-Claude Van Damme and Dolph Lundgren duke it out over who has the worst accent, as well as for a couple of other reasons. But check out both these reviews right now at RetroMovieNerd.com. Joining me, as always, on this journey is a man from another dimension. A dimension that is so strange that it makes the Cenobite dimension in Hellraiser look like a children's birthday party at Chuck E. Cheese. He is the Ayatollah of pop culture, Joel La Puma.
Hey, Chris. And to be fair, I think you're really diminishing the complicated subtext of Universal Soldier there.
What complicated subtext? You're telling me there's subtext in Universal Soldier?
Oh, miles of it. Miles.
Well, you know, it'd probably be easier to find the subtext of Universal Soldier than it is to find subtext in a David Lynch film. And I kid you not, man. I think Fire Walk With Me is probably the lowest review I've given a Lynch film. And I've actually gone back and watched Dune a second time, and it actually made a little bit more sense to me the second time. You know, the first time you're viewing these films, you know, like a David Lynch film, it's totally what the fuck. I mean, what the fuck's he trying to say? I mean, so I really find it difficult to enjoy a Lynch film on first viewing because there's just so much surrealism in there, you know? And it's hard to decode it. And I'm not the kind of guy who's going to sit there while watching the movie trying to figure it out. And then afterwards, of course, you're still trying to figure it out. And the movie's long over. It's like 3 days later, and you're still trying to figure out what the hell you saw. And so, yeah, if you want to get into David Lynch, you know, I recommend maybe watching his movies two or three times before you finally, you know, are able to maybe piece some things together.
And generally speaking, what you're talking, giving Firewalk With Me your lowest Lynch review, that seems pretty common for a lot of people. I know when that first came out, when it was first released at, I don't remember what film festival, Sundance or Con.
I think it was Con. Yeah. It was Con. It was booed at Con.
Yeah. Openly booed. which is kind of fascinating because his name commands such respect and among filmmakers and critics that, you know, I haven't seen Fire Walk With Me. I've seen a number of his other films. I generally enjoy him. I tend to enjoy his the first half of his career more than the current stuff. But I've also never seen anything Twin Peaks related, so that kind of colors my impressions here.
Yeah, I mean, I remember watching the original series when it first came out. Yeah, it was a weird series, but, you know, stuff made sense. The movie, not so much. And as a standalone, the movie really really will confuse people if you're looking for context into who these characters are and what they mean. And because characters just appear and disappear just very quickly within within Fire Walk With Me. And Kyle MacLachlan's only on the screen for a total of like 5 minutes. And,
oh, boo.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah.
I understand the booing now. That actually makes sense to me.
But we've got other things to tend to here, Joel. And by the way, how you been, man?
I've been good. How are you?
Doing all right. We're just shaking off some of the side effects of Hurricane Harvey down here. We didn't get the full brunt of it, but we were fortunate. It's unfortunate what happened to, the city of Houston down there, which is about 2 hours south of us here. We did get some heavy rain constantly for about 2 days, but we survived, and we're moving on now to our 20th show, Joel, number 20.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's been 20 episodes already, and we're going to get to our main topic here in just a moment, but we want to drop a little brief in memoriam segment here, because one of the greats of the genre has left this realm, Joel. We're talking about Tobe Hooper. Tobe Hooper, the renowned director. I mean, his big breakthrough, of course, was Texas Chainsaw Massacre back in 1974. Probably, in my opinion, on my personal list, it ranks as probably the greatest horror film of all time.
Wow.
It does, yeah. It outranks Halloween, my friend. Halloween probably number two, but Chainsaw's number one.
I love Chainsaw. I think I might put Halloween and Jaws ahead of it. And, in terms of visceral horror, I mean, then all sorts of, like, ghostly, haunting stuff that almost demands its own category. But Chainsaw is a brilliant film. I mean, I got a chance to see it on 35mm, and it's watching that, it's almost like the way it's cut, the way almost fragmentary way some of the scenes operate. It's almost like the film is taking people apart more than Leatherface. It's really fascinating stuff.
Yeah, I love the score to the film.
Oh, just my God,
the high, industrial screeching and throughout the film, it just adds to it. And, of course, the final scene of Leatherface standing in the street twirling around with his chainsaw, of course, is iconic.
Oh my God!
But go ahead.
Oh, I was just the scene that there's a million scenes in that stick out to me, but probably my favorite is the introduction of Leatherface. That brilliant shot from from the far end of the hallway. The guy's walking into the doorway. You get a quick close up that pans upward at Leatherface, cut back to the hallway. His hammer comes down. It's just so final and absolutely stunning. I mean, it's a lot of films when they introduce their villain, they do some big fanfare, like it's. It's a long lead in. This was just, he's here, you're doomed.
It was really, and it wasn't a lot of fanfare. It was just, a zoom out shot from, the end of a hallway. And it was very, it was a very more subtle approach to introducing that character. And I think, the other thing that stands out, of course, with this film is just, it took the insane inbred clan to a whole entirely different level. We've had movies about, crazy backwards families in the past, but this one really, really changed the genre, I think, in terms of that meme in horror.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the only thing that comes close in terms of that style of horror, that particular subgenre for me is Spider Baby, and that's a very different kind of film anyway.
Yeah, well, of course, Tobe Hooper had some other well-known films and some not so well-known, but of course, you'll remember Eaten Alive, about a creepy motel owner who feeds his guests to his alligators. Oh. And that was the follow-up to Chainsaw, if I'm not mistaken. And it was kind of, again, we're in the backwoods still as a theme, and we have a crazy, you know, backwoods motel owner who's knocking people off. And it's quite an interesting follow-up to Chainsaw, I believe.
Yeah, I believe so, because Chainsaw was 74, Eaten Alive was 77. I think that would have been his next one after Chainsaw. And, you know, Hooper had so many well-known, brilliant films. I mean, yeah, I'm a big fan of The Funhouse. I'm a big fan of Life Force.
That is a movie that has a little bit of everything, and it's all thrown at the wall.
I love that approach. I love that big apocalyptic feel at the end, which is something, you know, that Toby started playing with a bit in the 80s. I mean, of course, Poltergeist, I'm a huge fan of. I think most people are, although, I mean, there's obviously a lot of question about how much of it was his direction, because there's, you know, varying reports of Spielberg being involved in the production with an overly heavy hand.
Yeah, but still, and Poltergeist is actually a movie that we're going to talk about a little bit later here in our main topic, so this fits right in. But yeah, you know, Tobe Hooper probably, you know, Poltergeist would have been his attempt to really break into, like, mainstream Hollywood, like Spielberg. And probably that whole experience there probably made him back off, I think, from that whole scene.
Oh, I would imagine so. I mean, after that, he signed that deal with Canon to do three films, which gave him remarkable creative control, although I think the financial results were not in his favor, except for Saw Massacre 2. I mean, Life Force and his Invaders from Mars remake, I don't think did particularly well.
No, they didn't, but still, Tobe Hooper was a big one in terms of the horror genre, mostly, and so that's the reason why we give him our little brief in memoriam segment here, because he was behind the scenes of a lot of our favorite films, and this is a guy that's his legacy is probably going to be everlasting, mainly because of Chainsaw.
Oh, yeah, I mean, Chainsaw is one of the all-time greats. So is Poltergeist. I mean, for all the questions people have about how much of the authorship of it was his as opposed to Spielberg, I mean, it's an acknowledged classic. Of course, we also neglected to mention Salem's Lot, which is viewed as a classic TV movie. I mean, it really led the way for a lot of Stephen King adaptations to flourish on TV. In longer formats that suited how dense King's books are. And let us not forget his masterwork, which is, of course, the Dancing with Myself video for Billy Idol.
Oh, man, I did. I mean, I haven't forgotten Dancing with Myself, but I did forget about the video. I forgot that he directed that. What a nice little piece of pop culture to have tacked onto your resume.
I mean,
director of Dancing with Myself.
Quite frankly, that's Billy Idol's best song. I'll fight anyone who says otherwise.
Yeah, well, you won't get much fight from me, Joel. Trust me. with that said, we got some new releases to catch up on here a little bit, because we took the week off, so we'll run over them quickly. We'll start with last what came out last week, which was August the 29th. Releases from August the 29th. And the first thing off the top of the list here was from Olive Films, 1977's The Island of Dr. Moreau. It's a DVD release, not a Blu-ray, but there's no audio commentary. And it's interesting because the commentary is from noted paranormal investigator Jeff Belanger and a horror show host named Dr. Dreck, who I believe is an East Coast icon over there. I think he might be from Boston. But certainly an interesting addition to the DVD release here of Dr. Moreau.
Yeah, I'm curious about that one. I think there might have been Kino or someone had done a Blu-ray of that at some point. I might be misremembering that, but I'm pretty sure there are other editions of this particular release of this particular version available. I haven't seen it yet. Roxy has good things to say. I've been meaning to watch it just for the Michael York factor.
Yeah. And Burt Lancaster also stars in this as well. So I have a feeling that it can't be that much worse than, you know, the 96 version with Val Kilmer and Marlon Brando. You know, so definitely give this one a nod. If you've seen the remake from 96, then you have to take the time out to catch this one from 77. With that said, we'll move on to Vinegar Syndrome. They had a release last week. A movie from 1979. Now, it's called Snapshot. This release is titled Snapshot, but this is a film on Blu-ray, by the way. This is a film that has several different titles, one of which is One More Minute, and another, probably the better-known title, The Day After Halloween. So Snapshot from Vinegar Syndrome. I'm not familiar with this one, Joel. Maybe you might have something on this one.
I mostly know it for the obviously exploitative alternate title, The Day After Halloween. It did come out. I believe this is a 1979 film. And yeah. It's more of a psychological thriller. I know it's got a Brian May soundtrack. It's an Australian film. So it's probably a better film than you would assume from for a film that had to try and ride the Halloween train. I'd say it's probably more, and it does have Hugh Keyes Byrne, who we all know as Toe Cutter from Mad Max and Joe from Fury Road.
Right.
So it's Vinegar Syndrome. The releases are always really thorough, really beautiful restorations. And I'm always interested in, like, forgotten pieces of exploitation. Plus, I think it's on sale for the weekend on their website. I don't know how long it's going to last, but it's, like, $10 off on the website right now. So it might be worth looking at. Or even if you're at a because Vinegar makes the rounds at a lot of conventions, it might be worth stopping by their booth if you're at Chiller, New Jersey Horror Con, Horror Hound Weekend, anything like that. Chiller's at, like, almost all of these things in the Northeast.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds good. So, one of those curiosities from Vinegar Syndrome, and they always do a good job, so check out Snapshot. We have one from Severin that came out last week, Joe, from 1983. It's a movie called Suffer Little Children. Actually, it says it's a DVD release, but I reckon that they may also have a Blu-ray copy of this one as well. I'm not familiar with Suffer Little Children. This is a British film, is it not?
Yeah, it was kind of a smaller regional production in Britain. In fact, if you go to the IMDb, there's like the first review that pops up is an interesting little recollection from someone who was a background actor. I think this one might be one of the ones they're only doing on DVD under their Intervision imprint for their weirder, obscure stuff. It had a bit of controversy in Britain, partly because it's about a mute child with demonic powers, terrorizing other children. It's a shot on video one. It looks much more interesting than a lot of other shot-on video releases. Like, probably why they didn't bother with a Blu-ray, because how good is a shot-on video film gonna like look in any format? Right, but exactly. It looks like I'm not sure if it was an official video nasty, but it was one of the films that people railed against, that whole, you know, the Daily Mail uptight old British lady complaining about horror film era. Interview with the director, I think it's got some interviews with some British horror writers on the DVD. Zine writers. It looks like an interesting little obscurity, much more interesting than a lot of shot on video stuff tends to be. So this is one I'll probably be checking out at some point, because I'm always interested in weird regional horror.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, definitely. This is one that also piqued my interest. I'm always up for something that, you know, I'm not familiar with it, and, you know, the subject matter seems, you know, interesting. So I'll probably be giving this one a look out. I've got out from last week from distributor Pop Cinema. We got a double feature DVD, a couple of 1970s sci-fi sex comedies, I guess, is what we have here. Double features 2069, A Sex Odyssey, and something called Run, Virgin, Run. 2069 is from 1974, Run, Virgin, Run from 1970. You get what you pay for with these movies. They're probably low budget, sci-fi sex comedy romps with very little plot to speak of, and probably some bad, horrible acting and special effects. And so the mileage on them could vary depending on your own brand of taste, I guess.
Yeah, this is Territory Vinegar Syndrome covers a lot: weird, obscure, somewhat pornographic, somewhat genuine films. I'm always curious about this stuff. I haven't really delved into it, but it's such a weird era of film. It always intrigues me.
Yeah, I was going to say, Joel, I think the template for this type of film might be Flesh Gordon. Are you familiar with Flesh Gordon? Tell me you're familiar with Flesh Gordon.
Oh, yeah. Flesh Gordon is like the one pretty much everyone knows.
Yeah, that's the template for this type of
film. Those kind of porno parodies, like, I mean, even now, I'm sure they're still making them. Like, you know, I remember in high school, you'd turn on the Cinemax and there'd be things like Spider Babe and Lord of the G-Strings. Like, even in terms of, like, cult stuff, I mean, there's porno parodies of all sorts of horror movies. Like, I know there was a Reanimator porno parody. It's just such a weird little subgenre. I don't know how much I would delve into it, but especially the 70s stuff seems kind of amusing, kind of a weird diversion.
Yeah, definitely. So if you're interested in that little subgenre, forgotten era of cinema, that double feature DVD is something you need to check out. And also last week, Shout/ Scream Factory came out with a couple of good ones, both on Blu-ray. 1959's The Manster, which is, I guess, a B-movie sci-fi horror classic. Did they do The Manster on MST3K?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know if they ever did it, which seems like...
It seems like something that they would have done, but I'm not sure. Just the title. The title alone.
It is kind of infamous just for the title. I mean, it's two-headed man is the monster here. It was kind of an inspiration for the look of that scene, Army of Darkness, when the two ashes, the good and the evil one, are splitting apart. That's very much a Manster tribute.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, notable little cult film in that era. It's not one I've seen, but it's one I've been meaning to for ages.
Yeah, I was trying to remember if The Master's in the public domain, because then anybody can check it out.
I think this one might be.
Yeah. And then from 1986, also on Blu-ray from Shout, Vicious Lips. And basically, yeah, it's like, what is it, a female rock band who gets their big break, but on another planet?
Yeah, it's like a sci-fi satirical music, like rock and roll fantasy parody, by directed by Albert Pyun, if I'm saying that right, who did Cyborg and Nemesis, Sword of a Sorcerer, a lot of Arcane, a lot of classic genre films, like cheesy genre films. I've actually seen Vicious Lips because it was on a four movie collection screen put out a while back. I think Four Sci-Fi, that one was. Yeah. It's a weird, surreal little film. Pyun, like, when he's left to his own devices, when he doesn't have, like, you know, Canon or some other, or Full Moon or some other company, like, reining him in, he does really surreal stuff, more than you would imagine from him, which is how you get things like Radioactive Dreams and Brain Smasher, a Love Story, and Vicious Lips is definitely in that realm. It's a weird fever dream of a film. It's worth checking out.
This is one that makes the rounds on Comet TV. They recycle it every few months, and I've been able to check it out, and it's quite an interesting little odd film for sure.
Yeah, it's definitely like an LSD addled gem in the holograms. Like,
if that is the best way to put it.
Yeah, if that's the kind of thing that appeals to you, and anything gem in the holograms appeals to me, so it's like taking that and making it even weirder. It's pretty worth watching.
Yeah. Okay. Also, we want to give mention to a couple of other movies that came out last week. For instance, Ronin from 1998, Robert De Niro. I think good little action thriller. Small Soldiers was
Small
released
Soldiers.
Last week. Yeah, Small Soldiers got a release last week. I'm not sure if it's... I don't have my notes with me, Joel, but I'm not sure if this is some kind of special edition or what, but... It definitely is out there on shelves now. I just caught it in Walmart the other day, and I know there are some Small Soldiers fans out there. Besides yourself, Joel, you're probably the biggest one. But
this is
one for those 90s nostalgists out there.
Small Soldiers is the Gremlins that worked. It's amazing.
Yeah. So those are last week's releases. This week, kind of a light week this week for the first week of the month here. Release is coming out on September the 5th. Another one from Shout Factory on Blu-ray is The Spell from 1977. And I actually have not caught this yet, but it's definitely one that, you know, if you're into 70s witchcraft-type horror films, then this is one that you want to probably check out.
Yeah, this is one I'm probably going to pick up sooner rather than later. I mean, you know, we had a whole topic covering that kind of thing, and I haven't seen The Spell yet, but this kind of film, that 70s witchcraft vibe, always really interests me. So I'd imagine this is going to be a lot like Midnight Offerings, that kind of thing. It was a TV movie. I think it was written by Brian Taggart, who gave us Visiting Hours and Poltergeist 3.
Yeah, okay, that is correct. I actually see that note here, so the good call on that, Joel. There's definitely that pedigree involved here in that film, and it was written for television, and that was during a time when, you know, we don't get made-for-television films so much anymore outside of, you know, stuff that's written for a Lifetime. You know, we won't go into that, but in the 70s and, you know, most of the 80s, you know, movies made for television, there were some high-end quality films that came out, especially genre films. You know, there were neat little horror films written for television back mostly back in the '70s.
Yeah, I mean, even through the of course it was sustained through the '80s and nineties, even the early 2000s by many Stephen King adaptations. But I mean, you know, the '70s and eighties, you had Trilogy of Terror, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, Dark Knight of the Scarecrow, Midnight Offerings, a lot of really cool films.
Yeah. So, yeah, check this one out for some television nostalgia, if that's your thing. And then, Joel, I think you found one that's also due out this week called called The Ghoul. Tell us a little bit about that one.
This is one I'm not terribly familiar with. It's an Arrow release. It's a very recent film. One of their rare modern releases, but it does seem to be part. It came out only last year. It's kind of a psychological horror thriller. They seem to be painting it as sort of a almost new wave of British cult cinema kind of thing. My main interest here is that it stars Alice Lowe, who I'm a big fan of from her role on Garth Marenghi's Dark Place and the recent Shudder, initially Shudder exclusive horror film Prevenge, which she wrote and filmed and directed entirely well pregnant, like very pregnant.
Yeah, exactly. I have seen some plugging from Shudder about this film. This is one that's been pushing pretty hard, and I guess apparently it's supposed to be pretty good.
It's a damn fun movie, yeah. And a lot of people probably recognize her from a supporting role she had in Hot Fuzz, but she's incredibly funny, interesting actress and filmmaker. I love that she's getting more and more opportunities to show what she's capable of.
Okay. Very good. So those are your new releases last week and this week as we're all caught up. So hope you made notes because these are out there right now. And go ahead and, you know, pull a few off the top and check them out because if we talk about it, then it's probably pretty good, Joel. Yeah. So let's go to our main topic of conversation this week, Joel. You know, the big release coming out is the remake of Stephen King's It, about a group of kids banding together to unite against an evil clown named Pennywise. Y'all are probably quite familiar with this. There was a novel. I read the novel myself. It was a miniseries I believe in 1990. I've seen the miniseries. It was quite excellent. And, of course, I'll hold my reservations in check for the remake, as usual, because the remakes usually do not outshine the originals in any way. But that's another story for another day. What we're getting into is we want to talk about horror films revolving around kids, whether it's a singular child, a group of kids banding together against one evil force. That's what we're going to talk about this week. And what do you think, Joel? Why are placing children in these, you know, situations? What is the appeal there for, say, a movie-going audience?
I think a lot of it is that sense of vulnerability that comes from childhood. It's easy to tap into because I think everyone remembers, even if they're not thinking about it consciously, everyone remembers what they were afraid of as a kid. It remembers how powerless they felt as a kid in the face of what they were afraid of and questions that no one could answer for them. Questions about the nature of life, questions about the future, you know, how powerless you are as a kid in the face of authority. I mean, you know, people talk about childhood like it's idyllic and like it's easy because you don't have to pay bills, you don't have to, like, you're not totally responsible for your own livelihood. But the flip side of that is that you also don't, you don't have any responsibilities, but you also don't have any agency. You don't get to make decisions. You don't really have a voice in the decisions that are made about you, typically. Of course, that's all dependent on what your parents are like, how much they're willing to listen to you. But that sense of powerlessness, that sense of, you know, sense of vulnerability, that's always compelling. And I think there's something humbling about it. Like watching that on a screen reminds you of what you went through, and hopefully it manages to instill some level of empathy. I'd imagine yeah. A lot of the filmmakers were fascinated by childhood, by you know, that kind of feeling, seem to have remarkable empathy for what it's like to be a kid.
Yeah, I would imagine that there's especially movie directors who mainly dabble in horror. I imagine that there's a lot of inspiration that they draw from in their childhood that they use when when filmmaking. And I think what we can do is break this down in one of two ways. We'll start talking about single kids, kids who are maybe alone in their quest against this evil, and because that's one thing that kids are afraid of is being alone, and whether it's being alone in the dark or just being abandoned altogether. This is something that is an interesting take on the horror genre, and then later on we'll break it down into a group of kids banding together. You know, they're not alone. They have friends, and they all have their own unique, special talents or takes on the situation that they utilize to form one big unit into facing down evil. So we'll start with the child who's alone, the vulnerable child. You know, one of the first films that come to mind, of course, is Poltergeist, that we talked about earlier when we were talking about Tobe Hooper. Here we've got the child in this film, Carol Ann. She, of course, the iconic scene of her sitting in front of the television screen, letting everyone know that they're here, and then she disappears into another realm where she's alone with evil forces. And what do you think, Joel? I mean, she's got family behind her. There's family support, or there are families trying to get her back. But is there anything else here in Poltergeist that make a child feel like they're alone in this situation?
Well, with Poltergeist, it's an interesting case because there's also her brother Robbie, who's being tormented. He's got, that freaky clown doll. He's terrified of the tree outside. So what's interesting to me is that sort of contrast between his experience, which is a lot of like classic childhood fears, you know, things changing shape in the night, things that like seem normal by day and that seem malevolent in the in the darkness and the shadow, you know, toys that are supposed to be charming but just look creepy as hell. like that's a very traditional childhood fear. Carol Ann's stuff is more modern and interesting, I think, which is of course why that became, aside from it being bigger plot-wise, became the iconic element of film, because what she's being taken in by is, like, the fact that she's in front of a television calling out to forces, otherworldly forces coming at her through the media. I mean, that's one of the reasons this film has been so pervasive in our culture, I think, the idea that so many horror films about vulnerable children are about sort of metaphorical versions of pressures
the outside world puts on children, whether it's, you know, creepy people in the neighborhood being representative of, you know, pedophiles or the whole stranger danger thing. Poltergeist, it's about parents not understanding how to filter a child's engagement with the outside world, particularly with the mass media, which is interesting for like a 1982 film because God, I mean, you know, it's such a concern of parents now. I mean, I'm not a parent myself, but you know, you can't go 5 minutes without hearing a parent complain about their kids being too attached to their phone screens while the parent is, you know, absentmindedly playing with their phone themselves.
Right. Yeah. And that's something that's of course changed over the decades. Of course, back in the 80s is like, my child, you know, I can't peel them away from the television. Well, now they don't even sit in front of the television. You know, they now sit in front of their phones or their tablets or whatever the case is. And, but it, the concept is still the same, however. So I think, and you hit on Robbie and his more, I guess, traditional fears. That clown doll, man.
Oh, my God, that doll.
When I probably saw Poltergeist for the first time when I was like 10 or 11 years old, and that thing scared the shit out of me. And so when Robbie's like beating the tar out of it and pulling the stuffing out of it, I'm like, yeah, you know, kill that fucking thing. I mean, I couldn't stand that. Gosh, you know, thinking about it now. I mean, now as an adult, you think back, oh, shit, that's just ridiculous, man. But, you know, yeah, when you're a certain age, you can certainly empathize and sympathize with that kid in that situation.
Oh yeah, I mean, I still do because you gotta think. Obviously, that's not a toy a kid would ever buy for themselves. I mean, it's 1988.
That's something that his mom probably bought for him, and he probably should have stowed it at the back of his closet somewhere.
Yeah, or else it's like a hand-me-down, like it's something like one of his parents or a grandparent or an aunt and uncle had when they were
I don't think he's going through the Sears Christmas catalog and pulling that thing out and saying, I want that.
No, the poor kid wants, it's 1982, the poor kid wants like a Han Solo or Boba Fett figure, and he gets this
I want a Rubik's Cube.
So actually, like, that contrast works really interestingly because it's like these parents, like, it's, you know, Joe Beth Williams has a great line to Craig T. Nelson where when they're talking about, like, when this whole Poltergeist thing is starting and she's trying to get him to understand how serious it is. And she's like, remember in college when you were open-minded? And she's trying to get him in that mode. And it's like, these are people so caught up in this really stagnant, suburban, consumerist life that, like, they don't have any frame of reference for what their kids experience anymore. Like, I mean, the dad falls asleep in front of the TV. It's just, like, the most normal thing in the world to him. But, you know, through a kid's eyes, television static is just impossible, like an entire new world. I mean, they probably thought this clown doll was cute and funny, and you know, any kid would look at that thing and, you know, get a torch.
Yeah, and of course no one falls in front of the television to static anymore. They now fall asleep in front of the television to an infomercial about a pressure cooker.
Yeah. Oh man. Well, I think now they just fall asleep in front of Netflix, watching House of Cards all night or something.
Yeah, Netflix automatically moves on to the next episode of whatever it is you're binge watching. It's never ending.
Yeah.
So with that, we talk about creepy dolls and whatnot. let's talk about Child's Play, which is another movie that we can throw in here. I mean, we've got the child in the film, young Andy. Of course, the My Buddy doll is the was it called My Buddy? Or was that an actual doll?
No, that was the real one. That kind of,
yeah, that's right. There was a real My Buddy doll, and this Chucky was, I believe, it was actually based on this real you know, My Buddy Doll.
It was heavily inspired by that as well. Of course, the big Cabbage Patch Kids craze in the mid-80s. Chucky was a Good Guys doll, if I remember.
That's right, Good Guys. Shit. Yeah, I've seen the movie a million times. I don't know where my brain goes sometimes, man.
But no, I mean, My Buddy, like, yeah, I can remember those being still being in stores in the early 90s, and I'm sure this this film series destroyed that entire line, because I can remember yeah. not even wanting to go into the aisle those things were in.
So, yeah, I mean, this is another thing here is, you know, just the idea of, like, well, first of all, the Good Guys doll is actually ugly, you know, for one thing. So, I mean, that helps. That helps in realizing the evil at play here in this film. And second of all, I think Brad Dourif, of course, provides the voice of Chucky.
Oh, yeah.
He just adds a whole new dimension to this thing. Oh, you know, it's not just the tone that he uses, but it's the things he says. I mean, I think the use of foul language coming from a child's toy is just something that, you know, is just... It just works, you know. It works in spectacular fashion. Also, I mean, you've got this toy doll not just chasing after you, but it's cussing at you while it's doing it.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's that combination of like the sneering malice in Bragg's voice, and like, you know, that he's so vulgar and so like just that corruption of the familiar is such a common element in a lot of kid-centric horror films, because it's stuff you think you can trust. I mean, the thing about the Good Guys doll is that it's not just a doll. It's like this whole franchise. He watches the cartoon, and he eats the breakfast cereal. Like, it's just, it's like being like a normal kid being attacked by like a Killer Ninja Turtles figure. Like, it's something you've grown up around, and you know, it becomes part of intrinsic part of your childhood, just something you can trust. It's like, I don't know, when I was a kid, like, my home base almost was Nickelodeon. Like, no matter like what was going on, I could turn to Nickelodeon and feel a bit more comfortable with life. And for like a kid, like for like Andy, the Good Guys doll is probably like that. I mean, yeah, I think back when we talked about consumer horror, I talked a bit about how you know, kids like with a favorite toy kind of on it, that, you know, it becomes sort of an extension of your personality. Like, as you're figuring out things as a kid, like, your toy avatar is basically how you play out your own dilemmas. Kids play with action figures or dolls because it's a way they answer moral questions for themselves without even knowing they're doing that. Like, that kind of, that's supposed to be a safe place to, like, gradually approach adulthood, or at least an understanding of the world beyond your own age. And, you know, for that to be corrupted is a terrifying concept. I mean, and it's not just, like, a killer doll. It's the soul of a serial killer.
Like, yeah, it is.
So it's like the absolute like signifier of everything that's corrupt and, you know, destructive in the world in this toy. It's a great concept. And honestly, as good as Child's Play is, like, I rewatched part two recently, and I think that actually does even more with the concept, partly because the adult characters from this are written out. You know, Andy's in a foster home. His mom is in an asylum. And
oh yeah, that's right. His mom went crazy. So now, I mean, he had his mom helping defend him in the first one, but now she's gone, and now he's basically alone.
Yeah, and you know, as good as Child's Play is, Child's Play 2, I think, might even be better with these concepts, because for Andy's totally alone. He's got people who don't trust. He's surrounded by people who don't trust him. Who he's already sort of branded as psychologically damaged because of what he's been through. Like, you know, all the adults around him have, you know, very rational explanations for why he thinks a killer doll tried to kill him, because he's because like they're explaining it as the only way
he was able to psychologically process a series of killings he witnessed. But so that's like such a common childhood thing. Like, I'm trying to explain this to the adults. They don't understand. They aren't listening. Child's Play 1, he's got his actual mom there, who's a who, despite being overworked and separate from him because she's a single mom, is an attentive, loving mom. Here, he doesn't have anything like that.
Right, exactly. And so, yeah, I think you drive home a point there with Child's Play 2, is that that's actually more scarier for a child than the first scenario in the first film. Just because you're having to deal with this on your own. I mean, there's an assist from, you know, another character in the film, the other foster child of the home, that's kind of like, finding, in the end, you find someone who has a little bit in common with you, and that you can use that bond to help meet any problems, I guess, is one way to say it.
Yeah, I mean, Child's Play 2 is him and his foster sister forming sort of a makeshift family, but it's still a very precarious thing because she's only a teenager, even if she is, like, you know, experienced beyond her age because she's been shuffled from home to home. I mean, the first one, he's got his mom and he's got a new father figure in the with Chris Sarandon, who's a cop, which is, like, for a young boy, want the ultimate, like, this guy's going to protect me professionally. Well, a young white boy, anyway. this guy's going to protect me professions. Like, you know, it's a very traditional family. Like, in Child's Play 2, he's with a foster family with a mom who really does take to him and really... and a husband who's much more suspicious, and when the husband dies, the mom totally turns on him. He also goes to school with the worst teacher ever. And shout out to Beth Grant, who is a great character actress and is great at being, like, the worst, intrusive, bossiest, awful, like, woman you've ever hated in your school or town, like, ever. She's so good at those roles, and she gets, like, one big scene in this, and she becomes, like, everyone's worst teacher they ever had.
Yeah, awesome shout out there. I also enjoyed that. So, yeah, so covering that with Child's Play and, of course, Child's Play 2, we've got just a few other examples here of the singular or the vulnerable child. What about this one film that you want to bring up, Joel, of The Innocents?
The Innocents is so goddamn good. All right, for those who haven't seen it, it's directed by Jack Clayton, who also did Something Wicked This Way Comes, another film about vulnerable children in a situation that's beyond them. It's a really fascinating gothic horror based on Henry James' Turn of the Screw, but it's a very psychosexual interpretation of that book. I should also point out that the cinematographer is recurring Hammer Films director Freddie Francis, whose cinematography is so good in this. It's black and white. It's in CinemaScope, which was new at the time. They didn't want to do it, so he created this awesome these awesome overlays for a lot of the shots that were basically like borders that would around the screen that would get progressively darker the further out they would go, and the whole thing feels so claustrophobic. So basically, The Innocents is about a governess, a young woman. It's her first, like, position as a governess. She takes over at this one country house who's there's two children. They're orphans. Their uncle has ownership of them, but he's clearly, like, a very, like, playboyish type. He wants to stay in London and have his, like, fun, like, life, probably going to, like, the theater and picking up ladies, that kind of thing.
So she's basically in complete charge of the of these kids, and realizes over the course of it that their previous caretaker of the estate and the previous governess were having a extremely inappropriate and damaging love affair. They're both dead now, and clearly the kids were witness to so much of what happened, including just like straight up them having sex openly. Like, and the kids are sort of worldly beyond their years in a really corrupted way. Like, they act like, especially the boy Miles acts like a tiny adult in a way that he clearly doesn't understand what he's doing. He's just replicating learned behaviors. And she comes to the conclusion, because she's seeing these ghostly images everywhere, that these kids are being inhabited by the spirits of the previous caretaker and governess. But there's no indication how true that is. It might just be her picking up on that the kids have been exploited, possibly abused, possibly even molested by their previous caretakers, and her rationalizing that, because she has so little world experience herself, her rationalizing that through this weird fantasy. It's very oblique as to what the truth of it is. It's never really answered. There's a lot of strange things going on in the film with levels of experience, like at levels of understanding for kids and for adults. Like, her life has been very sheltered. She's a, you know, minister's daughter, a parson's daughter, and she's clearly very naive and very taken with the very worldly uncle that we only get to see when he hires her. But she's clearly like very enamored of him, and there's a sense that she might even be like sort of misdirecting this feeling that she doesn't know what to do with on this older story, or even on the son. Like, there's a very weird like level of intimacy between them, like, and so yeah, I'm going on and on, but so much horror centered around kids is centered around how much of the adult world they've seen and how much they should see and how it affects their perception of things. And also, well, the Innocence does that like beautifully, because clearly they've seen things that would shock actual adults, and they have no clue on how to process this, no guidance on how to process it. And they're not going to get it from the new governess, because she's so naive and so, you know, inexperienced herself that she doesn't know how to like really deal with these revelations. It's a film about, you know, a lot of horror movies, a lot of horror stories are about knowledge, corruptive knowledge, dangerous knowledge. I mean, that's Lovecraft, that's cosmic horror. But good psychological horror is about that too, and that's why so much of it involves children, because them trying to understand the adult world can create some really, really disturbing perceptions of things.
Yeah. And yeah, like you said, a child trying to understand, you know, the adult world, you know, that leads to a lot of confusion, and maybe, you know, helps instill some fear into them about, you know, certain things, you know, completely innocent things, but the fear is legitimate. You know, they wonder, you know, what's it going to be like when, you know, they get older. And, you know, that's a constant fear, you know, that lurks in the back of the minds of some children. It'd be just that, just being unsure of things, especially if you're a kid who maybe, you know, pays attention to the news and actually sees things that are going on, and at least a lot of questions that, you know, a lot of people don't have the answers for. Kids want questions, or they want answers to questions, you know, and you don't always have them. And that could, in some way, you know, cause a lot of concern inside of a child's mind.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the news, of course. I mean, you know, what's it like now to be, you know, a young kid that's Muslim or, you know, Latino in America?
Yeah.
Like, you know, what's it like to be, I mean, there are plenty of kids out there who are the children of white supremacists, Penguin, broad brush hair, Trump supporters who learned from their parents from Trump to copy some of his slogans, very bombastic language from his rallies and from his tweets, where, you know, shout that stuff out in school at their classmates without really having a context for that kind of thing.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, there have been tons of articles about with the perspective of educators trying to deal with students who sort of have free reign to just say all sorts of offensive things now because everyone's like that now.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of, going off too much of a tangent now, there's a lot of stuff out there that will cause, kids to question why things are the way they are. And then to find out that there really isn't any one answer or a more specific answer to that will satisfy their curiosity. But regardless of that, a couple more films in this realm of the singular or vulnerable kid I wanted to get into. I'm going to mention The Curse because Will Wheaton is the hero of The Curse. I'm not Trekkie for one thing, but I do know that there is some there are people who have issues, I guess, with Mr. Wheaton. That's neither here nor there. I remember him in Stand By Me, and I was fine with him in Stand By Me. But The Curse is one of those films that a lot of people may not have seen. And essentially, it's a farming family. Of course, the father in the film is a domineering father, and a wispish mother. And there's a meteorite that crash lands near their farm, and it breaks open and oozes a substance into the soil, causing their farm and neighboring farms to grow, I guess, mutated vegetables, and they're unaware of it. They eat the vegetables, and they become mutated zombie-like people themselves. And of course, Will Wheaton refuses to eat even after his domineering old man tries to force it on him. And so it's up to big Will Wheaton to save the day. The Curse is one of those movies, like I mentioned. You may not have seen it the first time around, and so we want to give mention to it here because it's one of those. It's B movie level, but it's not a bad story to it at all. It's actually a pretty decent, forgotten little gem from the 80s. So.
The Curse. Interestingly, it's interesting that they took that direction with a kid protagonist because it's an adaptation of H.P. Lovecraft's The Color Out of Space.
And yeah, that's right.
Although it's not a straight adaptation, The Lonesome Death of Geordie Verrill and Creepshow is very much inspired by that story. And, Stephen King's character in that is very much a man-child. I'm interested that a lot of writers, a lot of filmmakers seem to be connecting that idea of, fearful, corrupting knowledge that Lovecraft works with the same element in childhood. Will Wheaton, a poor Wesley Crusher here. And I'm not a Trek fan, but I think pretty much everyone knows that character's legacy by this point, although it seems like he himself has done a lot to get back in the good graces of nerds. that idea of otherworldly fearful knowledge, Lovecraft worked with very stiff characters, academics, historians, very rigid, orderly, rational types. But adapting that to kids and not understanding the world around them is, I think, a really fascinating way to go about it. Especially when something like The Curse, you've got because they're ingesting these vegetables that have been corrupted with this weird ooze. You know, his family's changing. They're falling apart physically. His dad's becoming like this weird violent zombie. Like, that fear that your parents aren't what they seem, that you won't be able to trust them one day, that things are going to change from the comfort you've known, is a big childhood fear. I mean, The Curse is sort of a weird combination of Color Out of Space with one of my favorite old sci-fi films, Invaders from Mars. Yeah. Which, of course, I haven't seen the Tobe Hooper remake yet, but Invaders from Mars, I think, which is about a very Pod People-like story where this kid's parents get replaced by aliens in the guise of his parents. And, you know, that kind of thing is often, especially in the 50s, was often a communism allegory. But in Invaders from Mars, putting it in the, doing that story with a kid protagonist, like, it becomes an allegory for child abuse. Like, his father alcoholism to his father gets very cold and stiff, like, hits him, and you can tell by the look on the kid's face, this has, like, never happened before. Like, yeah. Both The Curse and Invaders from Mars are, like, treading that territory where your parents are no longer your parents, but you're powerless to do anything about that.
Right, yeah. And so, you know, good subtext to The Curse there. I mean, we talk about, you know, movies on, like, the surface level where The Curse would be, like, you know, a silly little fun B-movie to enjoy on, a late Saturday night. But there's some subtextual layers to that that you just hit on. And so that was a good job there, Joel.
Oh, yeah. The Curse is actually working with some really interesting stuff. I mean, you know, like, it's about distress. There's an environmental, like, panic level to it. There's an AIDS epidemic level to it. You know, it's working with it's a weird, like, mashup of a lot of fears. I should also point out, just as a weird note, it was directed by David Keith, who, you know, people know better as an actor who, you know, was the father in Firestarter and, you know, a million other films, but that's the most relevant one here. So right. I'm not sure how much else he may have directed. I think that might have been the only thing he ever directed.
Yeah, it's a shame because he gave it those subtle touches like you're hitting on there that you could definitely peel back and see. And, the returns, financial returns, weren't so great on The Curse as to be expected. It was a very low-budget film. It would have been nice to see what David Keith could have done with maybe a bigger budget and more promotion.
Yeah, I'd be really curious to see what he could do with another film. Like, you know, even like, I'd love to see him like direct one of those like Blumhouse mid-budget horror films that come out every Halloween, like The Conjuring or something. Like, yeah. The Curse did get like three unrelated sequels because it was produced by Avidio Asinidis and Fulci himself was one of the producers. So of course it got like three Italian sequels that are titled after The Curse but have nothing to do with it, as is the way of Italy.
Yeah, that's the way they do things there. I think one more movie we'll want to hit on here real quick before we head to the break, that we could have like maybe a singular child at the center of it. I mean, there's various teenagers running around throughout this movie, running for their lives, but there's one kid who happens to stay grounded and tries to figure out a solution to the problem. I want to talk about the Deadly Spawn for a minute. And, yeah, it's from 1983, I believe. And this is a movie that, you know, is more well-known for being probably, you know, it's a cult favorite for a reason. It's silly, goofy, fun. The evil at the center of it are giant, for lack of a better term, they're giant, like, space worms or something like that. I don't know what they're really... They got a lot of sharp teeth on them, though. We'll just say that, so... But yeah,
another meteor born.
Yeah, another meteor born. You know, evil pod, space pod seed or whatever from space. You know, and everyone remembers the model, I guess. Setting, you know what I'm talking about at the end of the film.
With God!
Yeah, obviously, you know, obviously a lack of budget there, but totally tongue in cheek, I might add as well. And it's a good little film to check out. It's fun. It was a fun movie. It's silly, of course, but it's also fun. But at the center of it all, you've got the kid at the center of it, who's a fan of horror movies.
That's a common element in a lot of these films, like that sort of, and I don't know if that's just because so many of these were made, but these films were made by, like, people, directors who grew up loving monster movies and wanted to replicate that, but yeah. And that's probably a huge element. I mean, Deadly Spawn is very obviously, like, tribute to 50s sci-fi, but I also, like, there's also that element, and we'll probably talk more about this in the second half of the show, where childhood knowledge, childhood belief is kind of a saving grace in films like this. Not quite as much with The Deadly Spawn, although, because the kid loves horror movies, like, it gives him more of a frame of reference to deal with this thing.
Yeah, and so, of course, he saves the day in the end using a lamp and some duct tape, I guess, and there's duct tape and everything, I don't know, but you know, it's it was actually rather, you know, ingenious to the kid comes off as, he's not your typical, you know, clueless kid. He's actually pretty smart, and so, I mean, to with all of these older kids running around, you know, screaming their head off, you know, he's the one who manages to keep things on the level, and he plans out a way to combat the evil space worms. I don't know what to call them, man. They didn't even have any. We'll just call them the Deadly Spawn. But yeah,
so, the Deadly Spawn. They're the Deadly Spawn.
And so yeah, this was a actually a good depiction of, like, a smart child.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's always a tough balance with kid characters to, like, show them you want a kid who's smart enough for the audience to actually like, but not so precocious that they run into, like, cloying territory, like, say something like a kid that you'd see on a Disney Channel show or something.
Yeah.
Like, and, you know, I think that's one of the easy ways to get around that is to make your kids horror fans, because that gives them a frame of reference for the horror plot line that they're stuck in, but without making them, like, you know, the kind of kid who knows, like, weird facts about science that no kid possibly would.
Yeah, there's a fine line between making the child appear smart and then making them smart-ass.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, you're talking about those Disney kids, and they're a bunch of sarcastic smartasses, in my opinion. You know, they're always depicted as having, you know, the great little one-liner that's supposed to crack everyone up. But, you know, there's a balancing act there where you make a kid smart, but you don't want to make him smart aleck, because then you might lose sympathy for him.
Yeah, then it's like sitcom level, and, you know, if you're a horror film viewer, you're probably the kind of person who's resistant to that type of entertainment anyway. Like, yeah, I mean, you know, the challenge of making a kid-centric film is to write a kid, like, a child protagonist properly enough that your adult audience is able to empathize with them really easily. I mean, I think, like, getting back to Child's Play 2 for a second, I mean, you know, rewatching it not long ago, I was amazed at how good Alex Vincent is in that. Like, he carries the film, and the kid must have been, like, you know, 8 at the time. Like, and he, yeah. It's just, And the character's good because, like, he's been through so, by that point, he's been through, like, so much that you understand, like, every moment of cleverness he's got, you understand how he earned that, like, understanding.
Yeah, and you know, there's the thing you have to remember is that you had, I guess, the mold for child actors at around this time, of course, is Macaulay Culkin. And you know my feelings on Macaulay Culkin. His issue was the fact that he was the smartest person in the room, and he was smarter than the adults. Now, we all know that kids are not necessarily smarter than adults, but there's a difference between the writing here of depicting someone like Kevin in Home Alone as smarter than the criminals who've robbed so many houses until they've tried to rob Kevin's house, and then the kids in, like, Alex Vincent in Child's Play, where he's actually written to be clever, and the adults are not written to be dumb. And so there's a big difference there. You know, because, I just can't, fathom Macaulay Culkin being smarter than Daniel Stern or Joe Pesci. You know, it just takes you out of it. And so, you know, having that intelligence to actually write the characters that surround the child to actually be smart as well actually aids in a lot of this stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when adult characters in horror films like this are dumb, it's mostly because, like, if it's done well, it's probably because they haven't seen enough evidence to really believe the situation, or else they're just arrogant enough to where they, or rational enough to where this thing just doesn't seem real to them, which are both totally valid ways to write an adult character. In a film like this, I mean, Deadly Spawn definitely plays around with that. He's got, the adults around the kid are films they see as a sign of some kind of unbalanced quality to him. Like, especially because the more evidence he sees, the more they think, oh God, he's watching too many horror films. Like, it's really shaking him up because he,
yeah,
you know, like we talked about with something like The Innocents, that, like, ability to process the adult world. There's also a question, like, probably every young kid who is a fan of weird stuff like horror movies or Dungeons and Dragons or any Harry Potter, even, like, probably had an adult around them that was worried they wouldn't be able to differentiate reality and fantasy, because adults are very bad at determining how smart a kid is.
Yeah, and I'm one of them. I underestimate children all the time, Joel. Yeah, just throwing that out there. So anyway, we've talked about the singular or vulnerable single solo child. We've talked about Child's Play 1 and 2. We talked about Poltergeist, The Innocents, The Curse, The Deadly Spawn. We want to bridge the gap a little bit here. We want to take a break, though. And we'll bridge the gap on the other side. We'll talk about a movie like Silver Bullet, which has, more than one child character in it. We'll hit on that one when we come back from the break. So what we'll do now is we'll run those promos, and when we come back, we'll get into kids in a group setting. Stay with us.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apoitas podcast, The Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Welcome back. Go home in the box. We're talking about kids in horror movies. This time around, to start, we talked about the singular or vulnerable children in horror films. But now we're going to talk about kids in a group setting facing down evil. And let's bridge the gap a little bit, though. I want to talk about Silver Bullet real quick here, Joel, because, of course, the Stephen King story made for the screen. And we've got Corey Haim. And, but there's also his sister. Gosh, what was the actress that played her? It's not Sarah Polley. It was Anne of Green Gables. What was her name?
Megan Follows is her
That's
name.
Right, Megan Follows. I'm a Canadian, and I should have known that.
I was wondering where the Anne of Green Gables thing came from.
Yeah, she there was a television series on the CBC in Canada, Anne of Green Gables, television series adaptation of the story, and Megan Follows played Anne of Green Gables, but I couldn't remember. And it's like, I've betrayed my Canadian heritage. I've been in the U.S. too long.
You've been seduced by the Waltons and Little House.
Well, I've scarfed down too much Whataburger. Too much American beef gone to my brain. And so in Silver Bullet, we've got Corey Haim and his sister Megan Follows. And their Uncle Gary. Gary Busey. Everyone's favorite uncle. And we've got a werewolf as the villain, played by Everett McGill. And you know, what starts off, I think this starts off a little bit as the singular child, with Corey Haim being the only one who believes in what he's seeing. But eventually he brings his sister into the fold, and then eventually they convince their uncle as well. And so the three of them, you know, combat werewolf Everett and conspire to take him down. So it's kind of leading into a little bit where, you know, you think you might be alone. You know, you're as a child, you know, there's something you're afraid to face. And you think you're alone, but there's always family behind you. And so it kind of, you know, brings you into this group fold who people who, you know, it's a support system, so to speak. You know, Corey Haim is a handicapped kid in a wheel. He's wheelchair bound. And but he's not that bitter about it because he's got a good support system with his sister and his uncle in place. And that seems to really drive the story.
Yeah, a lot of these kinds of kid-centric horror films are about sort of creating an almost ad hoc family. Like, sometimes your real family, although like a it might be a dysfunctional family that's coming together through this, or, you know, sometimes your groups of friends. We're going to be talking more about that in a second. But you know, Silver Bullet is an interesting case where the where it's also set in the past, like a lot of Stephen King stories. It's very much a coming of age story about a family. A very complicated family coming together through this crisis. Honestly, I think the closest comparison here is probably The Lady in White.
Oh yeah, yeah, The Lady in White. That's probably one we should have probably brought into the fold here.
Yeah, it's not what I was thinking of immediately, but it's, you know, set in a sort of nostalgic past. It's about a complicated family getting stronger through a crisis, although The Lady in White is more of a classic ghost story with a lot of revelations about the past, but they're also very much set like about kids sort of coming to understand their town as sort of a worldly microcosm. I mean, The Lady in White has a lot about it's set in the early 60s. There's a lot about, you know, endemic racism still tied into small towns in the area. Silver Bullet, you know, spoiler alert, the werewolf turns out to be the town reverend.
So yes, just spoiler alert for a movie that's like over 30 years old, by the way.
But just don't tell me what happens to King Kong in the end. no, I mean, like, you know, so like a lot of these films like have an element of kids understanding the larger world through their own small town has a microcosm of that world. Or it doesn't have to be a small town. Small town, though. One of the other films we were going to talk about, another Everett McGill oriented film, People Under the Stairs.
Ah, People Under the Stairs. That's right. Yeah, with Everett McGill, and it was the character that played Mom or the woman. Gosh, I can't remember her name. I'm bad for this. Yeah, weren't they? They were in Twin Peaks together as well, I believe.
They were, yeah. I think Wendy may have done some other stuff with David Lynch at some point. I might be off on that, but I think she's reprising her role in the current Twin Peaks as well.
All right. Yeah. Cool. So yeah. Yeah. People on the Stairs, Wes Craven. You know, another film with a kid as the central character. In this case, we've got young Fool.
Yeah, who is awesome. And a lot, you know, People Under the Stairs, a lot of these films are also not just about strong family eunuchs, but also corrupted family eunuchs. Fool's own family is hanging on by a thread because his mother is very sick, implied she seems to imply she's got cancer. He's mostly raised by his grandfather and by his older sister, but, you know, they can't be there all the time for him. And, you know, he lives in the ghetto, straight up into the ghetto. And it's clearly, it's in LA. And then you get the weird main element of the film, which where he helps out some of the adults he knows, including Ving Rhames, who, you know, are thieves, drug dealers. I mean, it's an extremely poor ghetto they live in. And they try to rob this house, the Robesons' house, who live in an old funeral parlor. And they're basically the landlords for everything in this area. Everyone thinks they're husband and wife, but it turns out they're actually brother and sister. Their family has lived there forever. They have, it's almost like a fable fairy tale quality. They have like a treasure within this horrific maze-like strange house, like in the, like buried within this house, all these gold coins, these rare coins from various civilizations. Presumably one of their, you know, predecessors in the family was a coin collector of some sort. And they have the Robesons, who in the credits are just called Man and Woman, which is creepy as shit. they have a daughter and they have various sons. These are all like implied to be kidnapped children, and the sons are never quite like good enough for them. So they're like repeatedly locked up in the basement for years and years, at which point they become like these sort of ghoulish figures. Like they get no sunlight. They're deathly pale. They're all,
yeah,
they're all like, you know, they're probably showing signs of scurvy. Like, you know, their faces are all distorted. I mean, it's just like this mole people colony built within this house that's full of traps with this, you know, almost like omnipresent guard dog, like Everett McGill's running around.
He's running around looking like the Gimp from Pulp Fiction.
You know, hooting like, you know, a redneck from like an old like comedy routine while brandishing a shotgun. And like they're raising their daughter, Alice, like she's like this perfect, little girl, like they're dressing her up like a girl from an old convent from the 19th century. Like it's a very weird corrupted American nostalgia thing they're living in the middle of this, you know, LA ghetto. It's a really strange contrast. Like they're building this like weird classic America, this very sort of murder ballad, southern like Appalachian folktale America in the middle of the city, and oppressing everyone else with these horrific rent raises, and like, you know, they institute unfair rental policies on all the projects around them that they own, but they also own like all the liquor stores, all the like, you know, payday loan stores, everything that could possibly be a distraction to actually saving up money they also own. So it's this weird sort of microcosm of like predatory capitalism. Yeah, it's a weird combination of things, because they're like a Sawyer family from Texas Chainsaw or a Spider Baby family, but they're also business savvy, which is a terrifying thought.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, and of course, it all starts crumbling down thanks to one very studious and crafty kid from the inner city, who's probably more street smart than they are.
Oh yeah, Fool is awesome. And he gets the name from an opening scene where his sister's reading his fortune through tarot cards, and it talks about him as the Fool is approaching his I think 13th birthday, and it's clearly like it's very much a manhood story. Like you're going to the Fool's on the edge of a cliff and he has to make the decision whether or not to jump off. Which is, you know, metaphorical for making tough decisions that are going to lead to adulthood. And, yeah, it's a very fable-like thing where he's in this horrific labyrinth and he's trying to save all these ghostly children and this poor locked-up Rapunzel princess from, you know, an evil overbearing like false parents. It's straight up a fairy tale. And yeah. It's something we haven't really talked about in the context of these kinds of kid horror stories, is that, you know, so many of these have an element that's built up from like the kind of Grimm brothers fairy tales we tend to grow up on.
That makes sense. I mean, those tales were, you know, designed with children in mind. Children are reading those tales, and there's always, you know, something scary, I guess, traditionally confined within the context of the story. And you know, it's kind of like a Hansel and Gretel, you know, just stumbling upon, you know, some mysterious person in the woods and trying to find a way, using your own cleverness to figure a way out. And it really always comes down to, you know, especially in Grimm Brothers, you know, the crafty or the cleverness of the child on hand, you know, finding some way to outwit the bad guy in the story. And so a lot of these movies are exactly just like that.
Oh, yeah. People Under the Stairs is probably a bit more, straightforward about that fable structure than a lot of the films we're talking about. But, you know, by and large, especially these sort of kids banding together narratives we're getting into have that fairy tale element to it.
Yeah, I think we're gonna get into that now because, of course, the whole reason why we're discussing this topic is because of the remake of It, as we mentioned, coming out. And so we want to discuss the original It, the miniseries from 1990. I read the novel. I believe I read the novel, of course, well after the miniseries hit the screen. And, of course, you know, it's a tale that has some, you know, tragedy within, because for one of the characters, his younger brother was killed, and killed by the evil clown in the story, Pennywise, who was played by Tim Curry in the original adaptation. And all these kids had similar experiences. They band together. They had one thing in common. They had run-ins with the clown, and they formed their own little club to try and figure out, you know, a way to combat this force. And I think the opposite direction of, say, the singular or, you know, vulnerable kid who is alone or feels alone. You know, these what we're talking about now is kids who have something in common. They form together to form, you know, like a tightly knit sort of pseudo family unit. They're watching each other's backs, and I think that's something that, you know, provides a lot of these characters with a comfort zone, which is something they need considering the task at hand.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it is really there's a lot of things it has. In both the film and the novel are explicit about, which it, first of all, is that as much a threat as Pennywise is, all of these kids are vulnerable without him. Their club is called the Losers Club. They're all sort of social pariahs at school. It's almost like a very like archetypal quality. Like every kid is representative of a type you might have known at school. Like one's a stutterer, one's the poor girl in you know old clothes. One's the motor mouth hyperactive kid. One's the like weakling. One's the fat kid. One's the minority kid. I mean, of course, 1958, it's the black kid, but now it might be, you know, Muslim kid, Latino kid, might even still be the black kid, depending on where you are. And one's the Jewish kid. So they're already vulnerable. They're constantly bullied. You know, a lot of them have terrible home lives. You know, some of them suffer abuse in various forms. Like none of them is safe even before Pennywise comes in. And the whole thing about Pennywise is that he is representative of their like he can take the form of their fears.
Right, he exploits their fears
in a very sort of Freddy Krueger fashion.
Yeah,
but you know, for some of those kids, it means like taking the form of things from films that scared them, werewolves and mummies, because it's 1958. But for some of the kids, it's, which I find more interesting, it's more personal internalized fears. Like, you know, in the movie, I don't remember if this was in the book, Eddie, the sickly weakling kid with the overbearing mother, who in the movie seems to be implied is might be gay. I don't think the book implies that.
Yeah, I can't remember one way or another, unfortunately. It's been many years since I've read the book.
Yeah, the movie definitely, I think, implies that. Like, he's a hypochondriac because his overbearing mother has basically instilled that in him. And there's a scene where the coach makes him take a shower after gym class, which he's been terrified of because his mom's warning him about germs. And then like, you know, the faucets start staying, they all turn on. He's freaked out. He like sort of hikes in the corner and out of the drain in the center comes Pennywise climbs up. Yeah, makes fun of him, but it's not an actual attack. It's just kind of like the prelude, like, I'm here, you can't escape me, that moment.
Yeah.
And Pennywise, you know, it takes obvious pleasure in calling him a sissy, you know, calling him a girly boy. Like, that kind of thing, that internalized fear, is more interesting to me than the, you know, moments where, like, say, Richie, he saw I was a teenage werewolf and he goes to the basement to look for the janitor and clean something up. And it's like Michael Landon from I Was a Teenage Werewolf attacking him.
As opposed to just Michael Landon himself.
Michael
just
Landon
out
from
of nowhere.
Highway to Heaven or...
if Michael Landon was hiding in my basement, that would be pretty scary.
I could go for that. We could make that into the new It film. In fact, like, I don't know. I was watching a video detailing the Cary Fukunaga, I believe his name is, his original script for the remake. I don't know how divergent the script after he left the project is going to be. Apparently, some of the dialogue in the trailers is like exactly what was in his version, but he had this scene that fascinates me in conception, where Stan Uris, the Jewish kid, is getting ready for his bar mitzvah, so already he's freaked out because he's expected to be a man on his 13th birthday. That's just a great dividing line, something I'm surprised horror movies haven't done, because there's a lot of great Jewish folk tales that lend itself to horror stories. But he's in his temple, and
this beautiful woman appears naked and starts pleasuring herself, like, in, and it just absolutely terrifies him. I mean, like, that's such a great combination of, like, young pubescent boy on the cusp of manhood fears. Like, and I don't know if they're going to keep that. I'd imagine that might be one of the things that they think is either too offensive or maybe just too heady for an audience or for the tone of the film. But, like, that kind of thing, like, it at its best is deals with those kinds of fears that kids can't even really articulate well.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And that's, you know, in the remake, I can't fathom that's something that would make it into the remake, because, you know, it's something that you see less of, I guess, is more controversial elements in mainstream films. I'm talking here, and so I can't really fathom that appearing in this remake.
Oh, I can't either. I mean, clearly they mean for this is really hyped. They mean for it to be a big hit. It's probably going to be a big hit, and it might even be good. I'm probably going to see it because I'm really curious what they do with it. But you know, there's a lot of weird, objectionable stuff in the original novel, and people who have read it are probably shuddering, thinking of the exact scene I am. But I think this one is coming a bit closer to the grounded reality segments of the original novel than the miniseries did. Like in the miniseries, Henry Bowers was like a one-note greaser who just was an asshole because he wanted to be. Like, looking at him in the trailers for the new one, he's got the mullet, he's very white trash. So, like, you know, I think we're going to see more of his home life, because, like, it's pretty clear that, like, there's a lot of scenes in the trailer of, like, the adults around town are looking creepy. So that there's that level of the kids can't trust anyone that I think is going to be really interesting.
Yeah, and that actually is an interesting take on that, because that's not something that was in the original adaptation. It's just basically these kids were standing alone against Pennywise. But, you know, if you add into that fact that the kids can't really trust anyone outside their own circle, then that adds another element to it.
Yeah, because one of the things about the original book is that, like, Mike Hanlon, one of the kids, the only one who stays in town as an adult and becomes the town librarian and historian, he realizes that this is a cycle that perpetuates itself, like, every so many years. I think it's, like, 30 years. And that every time it happens, that these murders happen, there always ends up being a scapegoat, usually in the form of someone, you know, socially vulnerable, and the town eventually turns on that person or that group and, you know, kills them, and the cycle's over with Pennywise having gotten away with it completely. That's fascinating to me, because the idea that, like, the town is accidentally complicit in it just through its own prejudices, especially considering that the child half of the story is set in 1958, like, is a really really interesting thought. It ties in with the idea that these kids are, like I was saying, that these kids are coming to understand the world through the microcosm that is their town, like coming to understand that the world can be prejudicial, that the world, that authorities can be unreliable, like, that their parents aren't necessarily going to always be reliable. I mean, that's really interesting stuff that I think looks like it's going to have much more of a place in the remake. So I'm curious to see what they do with that.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a question about the original miniseries, the adaptation, and the casting choices, because this goes a long way into how we're going to feel about the remake. You know, the casting choices in the original seem to be almost pitch note perfect. You know, The one, of course, that stands out in my mind, of course, is Harry Anderson, because I thought his character, you know, couldn't have been played by anyone other than Harry Anderson at the time, considering, you know, where Night Court was at the time, you know, big hit sitcom. And that was, and of course, John Ritter, Richard Thomas, Annette O'Toole, names of some of the others escaping from at this time, but
Older Stan was played by Richard Mazur from from the John Carpenter's The Thing, if I remember
correct. And of course the big one, of course, Tim Curry is, will always be Pennywise, in my opinion. That was, you know, for him, that was probably the defining role for him, because he had to play, you know, a clown who was, how do we say this? I mean, he was a creepy clown, but he was actually enjoying tormenting these children, even when he wasn't, you know, when he wasn't trying to kill them, he was tormenting them. And then, of course, when he would bare his teeth, of course, he was the ultimate just scary-ass fucking clown. I mean, when people talk about why they're scared of clowns, they're probably picturing, you know, Tim Curry as Pennywise.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. I mean, I feel like the new one is going to be less – is going to be – because one of the things Tim does in the main series is – He comes on, he's creepy, but he's funny, and you can see where a kid might be weirded out, but drawn in a little like, hey, this clown is sort of goofy fun, because he's enjoying what he's doing, and then the turn happens, because until then, like, the teeth are normal, and like, he's making jokes, and then, like, the teeth change, and he's, like, laughing at the pain he's just inflicted, and he's telling the kid that he'll be back, there's no escape. Like, I feel like the new one is, I don't really know the actor who's playing him, Bill Skarsgård. I'm not sure I've seen anything with him. I'm kind of disappointed because one of the names being bandied about was Tilda Swinton, and I would have loved to see what she could do with Pennywise.
Oh, wow, yeah, I mean, but I know Bill Skarsgård. I think he was in the short-lived Netflix original series Hemlock Grove.
Oh, all right. Yeah, I haven't seen that, but yeah. So I mean, you know, I feel like just based on the way he looks in the trailers, there's going to be much less of that "I'm a funny clown" turn. Now I'm your worst nightmare kind of thing. I feel like he's just going to be that scary clown in the background in these old photos, standing by that creepy house, just always lurking rather than like in your face.
Those were some creepy ass old pictures, weren't they?
Oh my god, yeah. the casting in this is great, both adults and kids. I mean, I'm a huge Richard Thomas fan from last summer, from his episode Night Gallery. He's really underrated actor, but the kid
that'll
actor
be
like
on
Jonathan,
the stars.
Oh, of course, that'll be on the stars. of course, Jonathan Brandis is so good as younger Bill, Richard Thomas's character. Like, he's so good. And, like, Emily Perkins from Ginger Snap, from the Ginger Snaps movies has young Beverly. Like, Seth Green as young Richie. I mean, some young actors we're familiar with. And, I think that's where the new one is probably going to shine, because some of the young cast are actors I'm familiar with already. Like you have what's his name, Finn Wolfhard, I believe, from Stranger Things.
Okay.
And what's his name? Jaden Lieberher, who I know from Midnight Special, the Jeff Nichols film, which is really phenomenal. He was of course lead in that. And he's going to be Bill, and I mean, I'm probably going to see it just for him because he was so good in Midnight Special.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, we'll see. So the jury will still be out, of course, on how this all plays out. But yeah, from a casting perspective, I mean, everybody just hit the right notes in terms of their character, and so that's one of the things that probably doesn't get touched on a whole lot when people talk about the original adaptation. But yeah, the cast of actors used in that really is what helped that original miniseries hit it out of the park.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, especially because there was so much ground to cover, so many characters to introduce and work with, that like having people who could connect immediately, like really get across their characters instantly, was really necessary. I mean, one of my favorite moments is actually like at the beginning of the movie, practically, when Mike, older now, in, you know, 1988 or 1990, whenever the film is set, calls up Richard Thomas, and you know, these memories start flooding back into Richard Thomas, and he starts stuttering again for the first time since he was a kid. I mean, it's just phenomenally done. You know, and that's something we haven't really talked about in this topic. You know, that what makes it kind of special in these stories is that there's also the adult perspective on childhood fears, which we don't get. We get that sort of intrinsically just through the filmmaker's perspective on the other movies we're talking about. But, you know, it has an element of adults reconfronting their childhood fears, which they've totally, you know, put out of their minds, but they're never really gone.
Right, yeah. And that's not a perspective we get a whole lot of when we're talking about, you know, the kids' horror movies. You know, it has that plot element of, you know, the characters reflecting back, you know, in flashback form. Or an element where, you know, there's half the story of what happened when they were kids and then the second half when they're now grown adults. We don't get that perspective a whole lot in a lot of these movies that we're talking about. So, I mean, you have the adults thinking back to what exactly scared the crap out of them when they were kids, and thinking about it. And in some cases, in most cases, you know, they're reliving their worst fears. You know, and where it is in reality, you and I, you know, we would probably think back about what scared us as kids, and we would think that we were, you know, pansies or something for being scared of that. But yeah, that's definitely an element that it provides that other movies don't.
Yeah, you know, there's not many films I can think of that really worked for that. Like, you know, a bit more recently, early 2000s, that element appeared in Darkness Falls, the horror film about the ghost monster thing they call the Tooth Fairy in it.
Yeah.
Kind of a weak film, but that element of it was interesting. It's something that I'd love to see more. You know, there's the famous scene in It where older Stan, after finding out, and I think this is how the novel actually opened, older Stan, after finding out what that it's back, instead of going to confront again, commit suicide.
Oh yeah, he, rather than, you know, face all that again, he just decides to end it.
And
that's how frightening it was for him.
And they do some interesting stuff with him in a short time on screen, both as a kid and an adult, because as a kid he's so rigid, he's so order bound that He's also a Boy Scout, and he's constantly repeating like the Boy Scout oath, like to himself, like almost as like a mystic chant, like a prayer, while they're going into the sewer to confront it. I feel like now you could actually like just have him recite passages from the Torah that he's memorizing for his bar mitzvah, like, but either way, I mean, the idea that, you know, we mentioned earlier, like that completion of Lovecraft, cosmic horror, corrupting, you know, unnerving knowledge with childhood, with gradual childhood understanding of the adult world, like, that's exactly what he's dealing with. It is basically a Lovecraftian monster that takes the form of a clown most often, but, and his sense of the world can't actually handle something this otherworldly.
And of course, we'd be remiss in not mentioning the big reveal in the novel, and then the original adaptation, which, you know, I don't know. The it's like, it makes you question, and this is probably the negative point I'm about to make. I mean, the whole thing was great until, I honestly believe the ending was a letdown. And I was like, oh, man, I mean, then what did we just see? What did we just spend 4 hours on watching this thing? You know, it makes you question why take this form? Why torment children? I mean, what was the purpose, you know, without... I mean, I know everyone's probably seen this. Everyone that would be listening to this has probably seen it. So, I mean, why does this thing... there's no... really, is there, like, an explanation really provided, you know?
You know,
on screen, you know what I mean?
That's part of the issue with the miniseries, is that there's a lot of details that are going to be lost on audience that hasn't read the book. Like, the deadlights in the first half of the miniseries, which would have been the first night it was on TV, are not explained. So when one of the bullies floats away in them, like, there's really no explanation unless you know the novel already. Like, yeah. And I mean, obvious spoiler alert, but everyone, I think by this point, everyone knows this, the weird-ass reveal. It shows up as a giant spider. Now, yeah. In the novel, I'm pretty sure that the explanation was its form. So, and that's the only way that the kids could process it. Like, supposedly in the Cary Fukunaga script, it showed up as like a starfish type monster, like Starro from the DC comics. but a very sort of, you know, tentacled Lovecraftian being with a central glowing eye in the center of that, you know, is where the deadlight comes from, which, yeah. You know, it's almost like, which is interesting to me because now, like, you can do an image like that. I don't know if they're going to stick with that or just do the giant spider again, but you can do an image like that. I think audiences who have more familiarity with weird comic book concepts and with weird Lovecraft concepts, just through, you know, mimetic mutation, through cultural osmosis, like, would be able to accept that idea a little better. Like,
well, yeah, you know, the original, the whole idea of Pennywise, of course, he was a Freddy Krueger type, you know, appearing, you know, out of nowhere in increasingly creepy ways. And then to find out that, you know, there's a giant spider underground, the connection between the big reveal and the form of Pennywise was even created is kind of lost. Well, not kind of lost. It is lost in my opinion.
Yeah. No. I mean, it doesn't really. The like I said, a lot of it's lost on the audience if they haven't read the book or haven't read the book within recent memory. So, like, that's one of the difficulties in adaptation of it is going to have. And also, kind of crucially, the miniseries neglects to include the sweat lodge scene where the kids sort of, like, force on themselves, like, a straight up like Native American vision quest to find out, like, what it is.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you lose that scene, and I can understand why they, between a TV budget and just not knowing how to get that across, probably. Like, they would sort of shy away from doing that particular scene. But, you know, it removed some really necessary context to just explain what the hell is going on for an audience that, like, is going to sit there wondering how this weird, terrifying clown just turned. We know it can shapeshift, but, like, this, if this is the ultimate form, then why? The movie doesn't explain that, like, the novel at least tries to.
Right. Well, you know, I think what we need to do here, Joel, is shifters a little bit, and let's go to a movie that's probably a little bit easier to explain. Let's talk about the Monster Squad.
Monster Squad!
Monster Squad, yeah, because basically Dracula, Frankenstein's monster, the Wolfman, the Mummy, what, they all come to town and, like, in Dracula's hearse or whatever it is. I don't know. And we've got what else we got? We got Nazis in this movie or something. I don't remember for sure.
Was that the terrifying old German guy in the creepy household? They find out he's actually a nice guy because they need him to translate Von Helsing's journal for them. And yeah, it's very briefly, but very very vividly, like, shown that he was a Holocaust survivor. He has a number tattoo on his arm.
That's right. It's been so long since I've seen this movie. But anyway, so yeah, we've got a bunch of kids once again at the center of this, trying to save the day from a bunch of universal horror monsters running rampant throughout their town. Now, when this movie came out, I'll be honest, I'm not a big fan of the Monster Squad, Joel. And that's basically because, well, I mean, I don't have the nostalgia for it that other people do. Mainly because, now, I didn't see it when it was originally released. And I saw it as I was a little bit older. I probably saw it when I was 16. And, of course, at that age, I'm starting to delve a little bit into more serious subject matter in my movies.
Just a couple years too old to really, like, dig the Monster Squad on first viewing.
Yeah, yeah. And so the whole kids comedy routine surrounding these monsters didn't really wasn't really my cup of tea. And so, and I can understand how a younger crowd might be nostalgic for this, because this has some, you know, memorable scenes, some memorable lines within it. Of course, you know, the big line, of course, is Wolfman's got nards.
And the great thing about that line is that they set it up early by, like, debating with each other way beforehand what a Wolfman physically would be like, why he wears pants, like, things like that. Like, you know, it takes a very Bad News Bears approach to kid horror, where it's like, these are kids who, and it does this too, but it's a bit more nostalgic and a bit grittier. Like, these are kids who, like, they act like actual kids that you know or that you were. Like, you know, they're vulgar, they swear, they hang out in a club and they debate, like, weird minutia monster movies, like, you know, the physical reality of what these monsters would be like why a wolfman would bother with pants. Like, just things like that. Like, you know, I mean, that Holocaust moment is a really interesting contrast, because although these kids are dealing with an actual threat to them, to the entire world, really, like, it almost, like, that moment reminds you how, like, goofy and artificial all of this is, how it's really just childhood fantasy, because, you know, some people, like the scary German guy, who they call a scary German guy even when they're friends with him, like, went through real horror. It's an odd little, like, moment of perspective in this goofy comedy.
Yeah, and then there's the idea that, you know, for the most part, these kids are pretty brave. You know, I mean, these are real-life screen monsters that come to life before their very eyes. And, you know, there's not a lot – there's a lot of bravado in that group. I mean, maybe not cowardice is the right word, but for comedic purposes, there's some fear running through some of the characters. But for the most part, they're, you know, pretty brave group of brats who are more than willing to face this threat down. And probably because they, these are probably some of the least scary monsters in recent memory.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the elements of this kind of film is that, like, knowledge of childhood is, like, and belief in the unreal is a saving grace. So, like, you know, when the kids in It are kids, like, they manage to defeat It through, like, you know, through belief. You know, they believe that they can turn the medicine and cyan inhaler into battery acid, and it works. They believe that, like, silver will kill it because silver is always, like, the magic bullet. It's always, like, the purest metal that will destroy anything supernatural, and it works. Like, you know, these kids, they're not functioning necessarily on belief. They're functioning on, like you said, childhood bravado and experience, like with these concepts. Like, these monsters, yeah, it's frightening to them because they're being attacked by monsters, but at the same time, these are monsters they can wrap their head around really easily because they've seen all these movies. Like, they hang out in a clubhouse surrounded by these concepts.
They make friends with Frankenstein. Yeah, it doesn't help that they make friends with Frankenstein's monster, who is really just like a gentle giant in the movie. So, I mean, probably the biggest threat in the film is removed and turned into a big old softie. And so that probably having a Frankenstein's monster on your side is really going to help your cause.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much a film about, like, adolescent boy bravado. Like, you know, like, it does stuff like now you would never get away with. Like, these kids, like, you know, the fat kid who they call Fat Kid, which I'm not even sure you get away with that anymore, like, calling your own friend. Like, the bullies making fun of him, you could have that scene, but his friends, like, you know, they rankle each other about their weirdness and flaws. Like, the Horace, the fat kid, like, he literally picks up a shotgun and that, like, a police officer gets knocked out of his hands, literally picks that up and shoots, like, the little man. They spy on the one kid's hot sister and Frankenstein accidentally takes a naked photo of her, which they use to like blackmail her into helping them because they need a virgin to read the spell that's gonna, like, suck the people into limbo. And of course the big punchline is she's not a virgin.
Oh no. Like, and of course we've got a movie that and that is kind of odd because you know, we've got a movie here that is centered around kids, and then we've got a punchline such as that going on, which of course bringing sex and kids into the same picture is kind of risky.
Yeah, in contrast to what I said about The Innocents, which of course is set in, it's a Henry James universe, so it's a very formalized, very upper crust world. I mean, these are suburban kids that, like, but they're very, like, down to earth, like, salt the earth kids. The main kid is his dad's a cop. Like, these are thoroughly modern kids. And part of the joke is taking these tropes from gothic horror, like, you know, the purity of virgins, like, being a spiritual concept, and putting them in, like, in a modern age where kids are watching monster movies and making jokes about sex and wondering about Wolfman's functional genitalia.
That's a good way to put that, Joel. Very, uh, very intelligent use of a vocabulary there.
Yeah.
And but yeah, Monster Squad and It, probably the biggest examples of a group of kids in horror films. And I think for the most part, you know, as in terms of Monster Squad, you know, a harmless, really just a harmless piece of fluff. And I always think of Dracula and Company arriving to town. It kind of reminds me of a cartoon from the 70s, The Wacky Races.
Yes.
where every character had their own customized vehicle. And so yeah, the arrival of the monsters into town kind of sort of reminded me of that. And you know, so really, yeah, it's just a, I guess in the end, it's just a fun little nostalgia trip.
Oh yeah, well, what you so Wacky Races is pretty instructional here, because like that sort of tone, that goofy mashup tone, like old like Monster before the Monster Mash song came out, Universal crossover films like you know Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman or whatever, like, were known as Monster Rallies, which always made me think of Wacky Races. Always made me think of, like, you know, race cars. Like, yeah, like, it's that kind of tone, the goofy, like, throw in everything engine sync kind of like fun monster moment.
Yeah. So yeah, so I think we hit it on the head with this topic here, Joel, and I think we've got everyone prepped for and stoked for the arrival of the It remake, and so good job there, Joel.
I try. If it sucks, I'm sorry, people.
I think I'm going to reward you now with a round of Stump Joel. What do you think?
Oh, the cruelty! I'm in.
Yeah, Stump Joel, basically, I just got a series of, it's just basically what it is. I got a series of five trivia questions, and I'm going to try and test Joel's knowledge. Last time out, what did we do last time? I think we did 1984. But this time around, we're going to go to a little bit more of a broad spectrum here. We're going to do 90s horror. That's your topic, Joel. And I know you're well studied in this topic. And so we're going to test that knowledge here in a little bit of a light fluff piece to end the show here. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
You are ready. All right. All right. So question number one. In Scream 2, so Scream the sequel, Scream 2, the second one, what is the name of the movie made about the Woodsboro murders from the first film?
Stab, I believe.
Oh, ding, ding, ding. That one, okay, we'll you got that one. So, difficulty level, easy.
I'd also like to point out that the opening of Scoo totally ripped off Popcorn, and it still upsets me.
yes, Popcorn is one of Joel's favorite 90s horror films. Actually, I caught a part of Popcorn just on the side. I caught a part of Popcorn. Just the other day, there's a Roku channel called Shockworks TV that I want to let everyone know about. And it's basically just horror-centric. And they were airing Popcorn on there, and I caught the end of it. And it was quite nutty indeed. All right, so we're on to question number two. And we're going to go to 1999 here. The Sixth Sense was... considered one of the few horror films to be nominated for an Academy Award. What other 90s film, classified as horror, has also been nominated?
Are we counting Silence of the Lambs?
No, that's the answer. That is correct. Yes, sir.
I guess we could also count Ghost, because that was nominated for a bunch of Oscars.
Yeah. I considered, didn't see Silence of the Lambs as borderline horror, but there are certainly horror elements to it, so I guess that, I guess we can include that in the horror realm for the 1990s. And, yeah, Ghost as well. But, specifically we're talking about Silence of the Lambs here.
Yeah.
Question number three. Which actress was considered for the part of Annie Wilkes in Misery before Kathy Bates took the role.
Ooh. I'm not entirely sure. I'm going to take a shot in the dark and say Glenn Close.
Glenn Close. You are very close, but that is not the correct answer. The answer is Jessica Lange.
Oh, all right. I was thinking Glenn because of Fatal Attraction, but no, that makes sense.
Yeah, and I say you're very close because Jessica Lange and Glenn Close are almost similar.
They do have a similar style, yeah.
All right. Question number 4. Paul W.S. Anderson.
Woo!
Yes. Had to turn down the director's chair of this movie in order to direct Event Horizon. Which movie did he turn down?
Ooh. Let's see. Is it a horror movie?
Yes, it is. It is considered a horror film. It has other elements to it. Mm-hmm.
That both narrows it down and kind of destroys me, because part of me was thinking it was going to be like Soldier or something like that.
No, sir. No, sir. The answer can be classified as a horror film, but it also can be classified under other genres as well. That's probably the best hint I can give. Mm. This film was also, if we want to give another hint here, this film was also a... yet another sequel in this series.
Horror film, yet another sequel. Oh god, that's like the entirety of the 90s.
What year did Event Horizon come out?
1997. There's part of me that's thinking it was Alien Resurrection then.
That is your answer, sir. Ding, ding.
It was right. Oh, damn.
Yes, he turned down the opportunity to direct Alien Resurrection. And probably would have been an entirely different film altogether if he had completed that project.
Oh, my God, yeah. Of course, that would have been disaster. That film probably would have been a disaster no matter what, although I feel like he would have worked better with the screenwriting team. I mean, I know... Joss Whedon complains a lot about Jean-Pierre Genet because, you know, it's not like the director of Delicatessen in the City of Lost Children, Amelie, could ever direct a film that people enjoy.
I never understood the idea of bringing in an art house movie director to film horror sci-fi.
I would say it's probably just because there's a lot of really great, strange imagery in City of Lost Children, Delicatessen. And he was, getting incredibly popular at the time as a director. But, yeah it was not a good match.
All right, we got one more. And this will probably sum up the 90s quite nicely with this one question. Which of these films was not written by Kevin Williamson?
God.
You got your Kevin Williamson knowledge down, Joel?
Oh man, let's see.
I'm going to give you the list of films to choose from. One of them was not written by Kevin Williamson. All right, you've got The Faculty, Scream, I Know What You Did Last Summer, and Urban Legend.
I know he definitely wrote Scream. I'm almost positive he wrote The Faculty, and I Know What You Did Last Summer. I'm going to say Urban Legend.
We have a winner. Winner, winner, chicken dinner, ding, ding, all that stuff. Urban Legend is the answer. I guess on this round, Joel, you made out pretty good. Probably difficulty level intermediate, since we had a little bit of issue with the Paul Anderson question there. But
Yeah,
your knowledge of 90s horror is second to none.
Now, I should tell our audience that the topic was given to me beforehand, although I was really expecting like you to try to like stump me with sequels to Night of the Demons and Return of the Living Dead and Reanimator.
Maybe I should have asked you how many sequels are there for Witchcraft.
Oh, Jesus, I think
I think they came out with one every year since like 1989 or something.
Oh God, I think they literally brought it up to 13 so they could do Witchcraft 13.
Have mercy on us all.
I know.
All right, well, very good job on Stump Joel. We couldn't really stump you this week, so we'll try harder next week.
I don't know. I need a lot of help with I thought my Paul W.S. Anderson game was on point. This is kind of upsetting to me.
Oh, well. At least it's no Tech Noir.
Oh, damn that Tech Noir.
No. So I guess that wraps up another show for this week, Joel. And I always appreciate your deep knowledge and understanding of the topics on hand. Great show this week. And that'll be it. And so until next week, please remember your mom and pop video store, because it is the source of all your nostalgia, and I know it's mine. We'll see you next week.
Monster Squad!